Welcome to the Hilltop United Methodist Church podcast. Hilltop is located in Sandy, Utah, 985 East, 10,600 South. Locals would say 106th. Our two worship services are at 9 o'clock and 10:30. Hope to see you this Sunday. God bless. Bye-bye. Good morning, saints. Good morning, sinners. You know, I've done that now four times in the last 2 weeks, and you know what? Sinners keeps winning.
We are.
That's good. That's good that there's a recognition that we've all fallen short of what God calls us to be in God's world. I'm going to start today with the idea of why God? Some of the most important questions we ask ourselves are, why are we? Who are we? There might be people out there that would say to you, you know, don't worry about it. Everything about this whole creation, this whole universe is about whimsy. It's caprice. It's an accident. It's not a result of any kind of plan that all of this exists. I don't know about you, I don't find that particularly very satisfying. I don't find that very satisfying at all. We're going to take a look at the serious question of why, and we're going to talk about it from the idea of religiosity. But I would say to you, religiosity without serious reflection is all heart talk. On the other hand, all serious reflection without some religiosity associated with it is all head talk. I'm hoping that these next 3 or 4 weeks we have a little bit of a balance between the two, a little bit of a balance in our lives. Thomas Jefferson and his friends sat down that day in 1776 and pinned out what we call the Declaration of Independence. He didn't do it alone, but there was a lot of the creative juices for that document flowed from Thomas Jefferson. And he would write in that document, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men..." We give him an F on that one, right? All right. "All men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." There's, of course, a certain amount of irony in this particular document that as he pens this, Jefferson is a slaveholder, he owns slaves, and many of the people signed the document, so they can talk about certain unalienable rights on behalf of themselves, but somehow they can deny those rights to others. 30 lines down in the Declaration of Independence, there'll be a little soliloquy, a little reflection about the savages that inhabit the country beyond the mountains, beyond the Alleghenies, beyond the Appalachian mountains chain. Not exactly words that you would suggest are all about certain unalienable rights about people being endowed by their Creator. Lincoln particularly liked the Declaration of Independence because it provided a goal. It provided an abstract template for us to be able to try to move towards. He recognized that those who wrote those words in 1776, that was inadequate. They were not able to live out, for whatever reason, all the words that were there. But Lincoln could see in them an abstraction that would help provide a goal. Secular scripture, if you will, that would allow us to be able to establish the standard for what it is that we do, what it is that we say we are as a country. But at the same time, are those words satisfying in and of themselves? Certain unalienable rights, self-evident truths, creative force. Well, for a lot of the world, it is. A lot of the world, it really is an accurate assessment of the reality that's around them. We worship the Abrahamic God, the God, the Abraham is introduced at the end of Genesis 11 and Genesis 12, and multiple chapters that follow that is about the founding father of how we understand God to be Abraham. And we worship this God, Jews worship this God, and Muslims worship this God. In fact, 55% of the world worships this God. 55% of the world. Another 25% of the world worships some other God, and they recognize that there is indeed a higher power than themselves. We maybe should be prepared to accept the idea of the fact that if, 80% of the world worships a God, who are we to question that? Why don't we just go along with the flow? Why don't we just go ahead and go do that? Are you ready? Joke number one. We ready? Okay. Joke number one. There's a sign, there's a bumper sticker in Montana that says, "Eat lamb. 1 million coyotes can't be wrong." Now, if you think about that, there's actually something implicitly wrong with that. Because I don't know about you, but the dietary practices of coyotes includes lamb, but includes a whole bunch of other things that you and I would not want to eat. So the implication by what I said about 80%, just because 80% of the world does it, doesn't mean we should come back and say, well, 80% of the world does it, so we should fall in. There's things about that 80% of the world that probably does things that we would, in and of ourselves, question a little bit about how it is and who it is and how it is that they see who God is. Can we just sort of gently, maybe perhaps, introduce the idea of the fact that maybe we need to look deeper than just 80% of the world and maybe ask ourselves some questions about what some deep thinkers may have to say about the existence of God. People like Plato, people like Aristotle, people like St. Augustine, people like a relatively famous bishop, at least among theologians, of St. Anselm from England of the 12th century, C.S. Lewis, maybe even Dennis Shaw. What do you think? Yeah, that's your joke number two, and you guys laughed anyway. I like that.
How about Bonhoeffer?
As an aside, I'll get there. I'll get there. We have a joke about Bonhoeffer a little later. It's not in my script here. So. Why God? Let's focus a little bit on the fact that whether or not we understand whether or not God exists. Why? Because. Why? Because. Because people like Plato, people like Aristotle, people like Thomas Aquinas, one of the leading intellectuals of the 13th century, St. Anselm, St. Augustine, one of the leading intellectuals of that's ever lived, but certainly of the 4th century, most significantly C.S. Lewis, they all offer us some element of proofs of God. Now, let's be clear that these proofs that they offer are not about the Abrahamic God. They're not about that God. They're about the fact that there is something greater than us. And they depend upon intellectual stimulation for us to be able to follow it. For example, one of the ideas is things are in motion. Things are in motion all around us. And so something had to put that in motion. And so consequently, Plato and Aristotle believed that there was this prime mover that got everything moving. That's one thought. C.S. Lewis, I think, for me, offers an argument that I find particularly appealing, which is this idea of the fact that we're born with needs, and there are things in the creation that address those needs. For example, we're born, and we can have inside of ourselves thirst, and we're given fluids in order to be able to deal with that. We're born into a world where we have hungers, and we are given food to deal with that. He has a long list of these in Mere Christianity. I'm just giving you some examples of that. But his point is the fact that God seems to be, over time and across cultures, a need that the world seems to have out there. It's something that has existed for many, many years, and it exists across cultures. His argument is that this need that we have inside of ourselves is satisfied through God. Now, I want to acknowledge that that is not a proof of an Abrahamic God. It's just a proof of the fact that he believes that there is a higher power than us. Now, I'm mindful of the fact that any kind of conversation you try to have over the proof that God exists, you can get into a whole angry dialogue. There was an article about 6 months ago in the Wall Street Journal which suggested that religion and science could have some measure of compatibility. They could have some of that. Well, if you then read down the comments on that article, the usual suspects fall out and sit there and say, "Are you crazy? Have you lost your mind? Are you out of your gourd? There is no way that science can learn anything at all from religion." Despite the fact that there are very, very good people that are scientists, to include, for example, the guy who was the creator, who discovered the human genome, Francis Collins, in the language of God, he basically moved from a place of not believing in God, and the deeper he got into the understanding of what the human genome was all about, the closer he got to God. There's an example of somebody who moved from a place of science to a place of religion. But sadly, there are so many people out there that their reflexive, knee-jerk reaction is going to be, "Are you kidding? Are you out of your mind? How can a person of reason like you believe in God?" People you and I have never heard of in our whole lives and will never ever hear of again once we get past the Wall Street Journal little article there with their little name down there. But they're basically saying, I don't care who he is, Plato is wrong. I don't care who he is, Aristotle is wrong. I don't care who he is, St. Augustine is wrong. I don't care who he is, C.S. Lewis is wrong. And I never heard of this guy, Dennis Shaw, but he's definitely wrong. So the question is that If some of those other names are like that, cannot prove to some people's satisfaction that God exists, let's all be candid with each other. You and I are not going to be able to explain and be able to persuade to people that God exists. St. Augustine basically said there's three ways people come to be followers of God. One is a faith statement. You just accept the fact that God exists. For whatever reason, you feel like there's something about it that appeals to you, and you decide that you want to believe in God. The second thing happens is you have an experience. You have a religious experience that moves you from a place of disbelief to a place of belief. C.S. Lewis had that happen to him. I had that happen to me. I'm not saying I was a total non-believer. I'm not saying that. But I was a skeptic. And I had a faith experience that moved me from that skepticism to a place of faith. And finally, you can have some kind of academic proof that God exists. Like I said, if St. Augustine is not going to be able to prove to people that God exists, you and I are not going to be able to prove to people that God exists. If they don't want to believe that God exists, that's where they're going to be stuck. They're going to get stuck there without being able to go back and understand the wisdom of Jefferson when he writes, "We believe that people are given their rights, certain unalienable rights, by their Creator." And they just prepared to wander off in their own wilderness and say they reject that. But let's take Jefferson's idea, because it is indeed based upon this book. Let's indeed take Jefferson's idea and remember that God is a creative force. God is a creative power. I don't know about you, but even in my skepticism period, I would wander around places like these mountains. When I would go skiing in Colorado in the 1970s, 1980s, I would stand on top of these mountains and look out over the creation, and my heart beat a little bit faster because it was all so beautiful. It was all so fantastic. And that is essentially one of Thomas Aquinas' proof. This is the fact that the beauty is out there. You have to come up with another explanation as to how this is all here if you're not careful. So for me, I sort of rejected the idea this was all a function of caprice and whimsy. Now, at the 9 o'clock service, I asked the question, "What's the second law of thermodynamics?" And the answer was Bonhoeffer. Okay, everybody, the second law of thermodynamics is not Bonhoeffer. Okay. The second law of thermodynamics, I'm going to give it to you cleaned up. This is the Shaw version of it because they talk about terms of entropy and things like that. I don't know about you. I haven't used entropy in a sentence in my adult life. Have you ever used it?
No.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. We've got an engineer here.
Nursing.
Okay. Second law of thermodynamics is the fact that left of its own devices, things will move from a place of order to a place of disorder. Well, what is it that God does? What is one of the things that God does? God flips that. God changes the equation. God moves us from a place of disorder to a place of order. Now, I want to digress a little bit and reflect a little bit about how some of our understanding, somehow some of this book got put together. And it got put together when the children of Israel, when the Jews, were prisoners of the Babylonians in Babylon in the 6th century. And the Babylonian gods, they don't exist anymore, but they don't exist anymore because they never existed. But at the end of the day, the Babylonian gods were seen by the Babylonians as you and me writ large. They were just like you and me. They failed in the way you and I failed. They ran around heaven doing things human beings do. Crazy, ridiculous, stupid kinds of things. But the point of the Babylonian gods, one of the points of the Babylonian gods was, is the fact that the creation that we see around us here was all an accident. It was all caprice. It was all whimsy. It was not the result of any kind of organized plan. The gods, the world exists as a result of accident. And frankly, if you think about it from the human condition perspective, that can explain a whole lot of good things for you. You can say, well, it doesn't matter. That's how it all got created anyway. It's a great big accident. So I can be the center of my universe. The Israelites, the Jews, sat down and went back into the inventory of their stories, went back into the experiences that they had had with God, and they started to ask themselves some deep, serious questions about who is God, whose are we, what's going on with us, and that was how parts of this book got formed during that time frame. And one of the things that they expressly rejected was the idea of the fact that this Babylonian idea of who God was incompatible with who they understood God to be. God, there was a created order to the universe. There was an intentionality to it. There was a plan associated with that. For those of you that were here last week, you heard me preach off of Job. And the passage there that we used out of Job was this idea where Job says, God, come down here, I want a piece of you. And Job and God finally says, okay, Job, here I am. But before we talk any more about this, I want to have a piece of you. And he says, who is it that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? In other words, who the heck are you to be asking me what went on? And then he comes back and expresses it very clearly. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. The Bible tells us there's a created order to the universe. Here, write the very first words of the Bible. In Genesis, in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep. Then God said, let there be. There was a creative plan associated with that. And the New Testament scholars, the New Testament writers, those who were writing the memoirs of the apostles, in this case John, would hearken back to that created order that existed in Genesis, and they would remind us that Jesus was there as part of that. In the beginning, this is John 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And without Him, not one thing came into being. So part of the idea is this idea of this rejection of the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics is left of its own, things move from a state of order to a state of disorder. God helps move us from a place of disorder to a place of order, from a place of chaos to a place of structure. God's present. The second thing that they had in the Babylonian adventure was the fact that God's present here. They reminded themselves that God was without boundaries. God did not exist only in Canaan. God did not exist only in Israel. God did not exist only in Judah. Rather, God was boundaryless. So all of that helps us perhaps with background of understanding of where it is and what it is that we need to think about. I'm trying to ask ourselves the question about why God? What does God do that we need to respond to? What is it that we need to do? How does it help us in the world? Why are we? Who are we? And perhaps most important, whose are we? Joke number two? Or is this joke number three? It's joke number two, I guess. Meryl says joke number three, so she's always right. Okay? Whenever she's mistaken, see rule one, right? Not Marilyn, by the way. A man tells a story about his wife and how she treats him and says, "My wife treats me like I'm God." Okay, I haven't got the punchline yet. And then he says, she acknowledges my presence, but she actually only calls upon me when she really needs me. I wonder if that's not how God is for most of us. What is it that we need from God? This idea of bringing order out of disorder, design out of chaos. How it is that we reject the Babylonian gods of our own world, which suggests to us that everything is caprice, everything is an accident, everything's whimsy. Genesis 3 rejects one of the messages that the world would try to say to us. The world would try to say to you, you are indeed the center of your universe. Everything revolves around you. You are the most important person in your whole life. And that's not an unusual thought, because if you think about it, everything that we see in the world is filtered through what? Our eyes. Everything we understand of the world is filtered through what? Our understanding. And Genesis 3 comes down and reminds us that no, we are not the center of the universe. And we understand who we are and whose we are by looking back to that book. That book that helps gives us these instructions on how it is that we go about living our lives. It provides for us the standards by which we exist. Amos 7. God tells Amos that he wants to give them something that will help them lead their life. And what is that? I'm going to give you a plumb line. I'm setting a plumb line in the midst of my people. Plumb line, for those of you that haven't built a house, is something that allows us to be able to establish what a straight line is before we had levels. It could do that. It helped us do that. So the plumb line could tell us clearly what it is that was straight, what it is, how it was that we go about leading our lives. That's not a unique thought in the Old Testament or the Bible in general. In Proverbs, the prayer Mike Heinz read to us was based in part on Proverbs 3. And here, the translation I'm using is, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not rely on your own insight." Do not rely on your own insight. Rely on God's insight, God's wisdom, therefore. "In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord, be in awe of the Lord, and turn away from evil." When Peter would be hauled into the Sanhedrin post-resurrection, post-Pentecost, in Acts 5, he would be told, this Jesus stuff is too dangerous. We don't want you going out teaching this Jesus stuff. And Peter and his compadres, his fellow apostles, would say, "We are going to teach Jesus. We're going to teach God." Let me get over here. I'm just going to try to do it from memory, and I can't do it. So here we are. That's a joke too. But Peter and the apostles answered, "We must obey God rather than any human authority." In other words, this book is above the secular scripture in our country. I know that that's a heresy out there to some people, but that's exactly that. And frankly, if you think about what Jefferson was driving at, he was saying that the standards of what has been given to us by the creative presence is greater than the laws of England. He's using the same kind of argument, same kind of logic endowed by our Creator. Finally, I want to conclude with the idea, at least this section, with the idea of what it is that God gives us this goal of understanding what it is to be in relationship. In the New Testament, the word that we translate sin, at least one of the words that we use to translate sin, is an archery term. It's an archery term. If you think about it, how do you do archery? You pull up the bow, and you take the string, and you pull it back like this, and you let go of it, and what happens? You either hit the mark, or you miss the mark. Well, the word that's translated as sin in the New Testament is the word for you missed the mark. You've missed the mark. So sin is sometimes those times where you've missed the mark. Whose mark? God's mark. God's mark is called upon us. So why God? God provides for us this order out of the chaos of our lives. Joshua is dealing with this. Joshua is dealing with within the passage that Mary Jean read for us, this idea of who are you going to worship? What God are you going to worship? Now, here's the truth for you. Even those people, even the people who sit down and say, like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and other people like that, they sit down and say, God doesn't exist, they still worship a God. It's just, what God do you want to worship? Do you want to worship money? Do you want to worship beauty? Do you want to worship political power? What is it you want to worship? And Joshua is dealing with that. And he clearly is asking the group there. He turns around and says, now therefore revere the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods that you knew before. Put away those gods. Put away the gods from beyond the river. Put away the gods from Egypt. But we want you to serve the Lord. If you're unwilling to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve. Choose this day whom you will serve. You're going to have to serve somebody something. So be about choosing that. And he says, but as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. He is making a conscious choice to say, this God is the God I am going to follow. Not the God that the Babylonians' voices, even in our own world today. We can sit there and say, Dennis, the Babylonians are long since gone. Their gods are still present. Their gods are still present in the fact that we still listen to those gods, listen to the world tell us that the world's values trump the values found in this book. So the question is, why? Well, the first because is we have this strong inner need. We have this hole in our soul, and we seek God, and God's call upon us to help us fill that hole. And we enter into a lifelong quest. You don't sit there and say, God, I want you in my life, and all of a sudden you take a pill and everything is magic. Okay? It's a lifelong quest to figure out what it is that God calls you to do. That's our why, is because we have this inner need. Why? Because it's part of the answer of who we are. We're not our own. We're not the center of the universe. We're God's. We're God's. We're God's created presence in this world. And we're a little bit above the angels. A little bit above the angels. But we're a little bit below God. There's a present peace of God inside of each of us that is in no one else. Why? Because God provides for us a template for how it is to be in relationship. How it is that we get this plumb line. How it is that we establish when we've hit the mark or we've missed the mark. The Ten Commandments. You can sit there and look at the Ten Commandments and make the assumption it's all about relationship with God. It's not. Depending upon how you count them, four or five of the first ten are about what it is to be in relationship with God. But five or six, depending upon, again, how you count, is about being in relationship with the world around us, with each other. That's an important part of that. God's basically saying, here's the 10 important things. Half of them are about your relationship with me, and half of them are about your relationship with each other. Part of how it is that we become human, truly human, is by understanding that God calls us to follow this template of relationship. Because God reverses the natural order, this idea of the second law of thermodynamics, where everything moves from order to chaos left to its own. God moves us the other way around. God moves us from a place of chaos to a place of order, from a place of disorder to a place of order. That's one of the reasons we want to allow God in. Why? Because it allows us to say we have been endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. And we offer an assent to that. And we can still sit down and acknowledge that Jefferson and those who wrote those words were failing as they wrote those words. But we can still endorse the words because they provide an abstract reality for us to continue to move towards a plumb line, a measurement of how it is that we go about missing that mark. So you may come in and go, gee, I just still wander. I still wander out there and I'm lost. I'm just so lost in how it is that I want to understand God. Tolkien tells us that all who wander are not lost. Continue that wandering. Continue plugging in. Continue asking the questions, the important questions of who are we, why are we, whose are we? Joke number four. Sunday school class occurs, and the teacher asks the students in the class, what is one thing that God cannot do? And she frankly expects no answer. God's all-powerful. God's omnipotent. God has all the power in the whole universe and can do anything God wants. And Johnny raises his hand. She's sort of a little disgusted because she wanted Johnny to say, who want everybody in the class to go, there's nothing that God can't do. There's nothing that God can't do. She says, okay, Johnny, what is it that God can't do? God can't make us all happy. God cannot make us all happy. God could choose to make us all happy, but God chooses not to. C.S. Lewis, in his wonderful treatise, Mere Christianity, writes, God made us. God invented us as a person invents an engine. A car is made to run on gasoline, and it would not run properly on anything else. Now, God designed the human machine to run on God. God is the fuel for our spirits. God is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, or the food our spirits were designed to feed on. There is no other. That is why it's just no good asking God to make us happy in our own way without bothering about religion. God cannot give us a happiness and peace apart from himself because it is not there. Joshua is asked the question, is dealing with the nature of what's going on there. They say they keep getting this momentum to go do other kinds of things. And Joshua says, you know, you can go worship the gods from Babylon. You can go worship the gods of the Egyptians. You can go worship the gods of the Amorites if you want to. But for me and my people, I'm going to follow the God that's laid out in this book. I don't know how satisfying it is for you. It's pretty satisfying for me. But at the end of the day, you either have to accept who God is on faith, you have to have an experience, you have to be able to prove that God exists. One of those three. The choice on that is yours. In a moment or two, we're going to sing hymn number 396. Do I have that right? 396. As we do that, pay attention to the second and the third verses, because I think the second and third verses are dealing with some of the questions that we ask here this morning. Now, here's where the real hard part comes. This is not one sermon. This is not one sermon that's an hour long. I know you're going to try to beat the Baptist to the buffet, but we're not going to do it today. But at the end of the day, this sermon ends for momentarily. We're going to pick it back up next Sunday at either 9 o'clock or at 10:30. We're going to pick it back up. Then we're going to do that again. We're going to do that again. All right? It's really sort of one long hour and a half sermon that spans about 4 weeks. Each builds upon the other. Why? Because God loves us. Because God calls us to be different than what the world would have us be. Please stand as you are able. Hilltop is located in Sandy, Utah, 985 East, 10,600 South. Locals would say 106th. Our two worship services are at 9 o'clock and 10:30. Hope to see you this Sunday. God bless. Bye-bye.